This is The Reading Sampler, a program of contemporary fiction, biography, autobiography, and occasional essay and poetry. Your guide in sampling the literature of today is Dorothy Doyle. Rabbi Melka Drucker is the author of some 20 books, and over the past 10 years, we have read from many of them here on The Reading Sampler. For example, Jacob's Rescue, Rescuers, Portraits of Moral Courage in the Holocaust, Frida Kahlo, A Lesson in Survival, and in 2003, Melka published Whitefire, A Portrait of Women Spiritual Leaders in America, with photographs by Gay Block. Her wonderful book, The Family Treasury of Jewish Holidays, gives us an overview of all the holidays. So we've invited Rabbi Melka Drucker, leader of the HaMakom community of Santa Fe, New Mexico, to tell us the story of Passover, which is celebrated this very day. So we want to welcome to The Reading Sampler Rabbi Melka Drucker.
I'm glad to be here, Dorothy.
I'm going to call you Melka.
Please do.
All right. You say here that Passover holiday is a time to prepare, to turn the house into a sanctuary, to get ready for the Seder table. Pesach, you say, is the holiday that celebrates our birth as a people, out of Egypt, emerging from the broken waters of the Sea of Reeds and coming out of slavery. So I'd like you to tell us today the story of Passover and tell us about these terms that people may be unfamiliar with. Tell us what happened in this history of the coming out of Egypt and how it is celebrated today, thousands of years later, what we can learn from it and apply to our lives. So now I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Dorothy. You know, this is the one holiday that if a Jew remembers any holiday, this is the one that will be remembered best, I think, because it's celebrated at home. It really is not a synagogue function. And the idea of suddenly seeing your parents be turned into the spiritual leaders of the home for this short period of time really demonstrates the strength of a tradition that has faith enough in us to be able to carry this at home. The other reason I think that it is so well remembered is it's such a rip-roaring story. And I'll begin it once upon a time. The story actually begins with the remembering of a much better time, which was the time of Joseph, when, in fact, the Israelites really enjoyed great comfort and privilege within Egypt. And this was a king that, although they were in the diaspora in a strange land, they had a friend. As is often the case in Jewish history, that can turn on a dime. And when the Pharaoh died under Joseph and a new Pharaoh arose, as the book reads, this Pharaoh heard from his advisors that the Jews, a Hebrew, would rise up and triumph over him, the Pharaoh. So because of that, he decided to enslave the Jewish people and make them do hard labor, and which they did. And then a harsher decree came. The harsher decree was that every male child, since the prophecy was that it would be a male Hebrew who would conquer him, every male Jewish child should be destroyed. And they had Egyptian midwives. So that being said, it did not discourage most of the Hebrews. The women were very resourceful, as is again in the Torah and the five books. Again and again, the women are the movers and the shakers. The women would go. The men were separated from the women to prevent conception. The women would go meet the men where they were building storehouses for the Pharaoh, bring them lunch, make love under the trees, and lo and behold, they would conceive. Despite this, the most respected person in the entire community, Amram, decided to divorce his wife, Yocheved. They had two children already, Aaron and Miriam. Miriam, whom we know as the prophet, also learned to be a midwife with her mother, and she would blow in the ear of a woman in labor, and this would help facilitate the birth. When she sees her parents struggling and fighting, and the father decides to divorce the mother so that they do not have this terrible, agonizing dilemma of what to do if they have a male child, she says to the father, "You're worse than the Pharaoh. He only wants to kill half of us. You're going to try to kill all of us." And he thinks about this, and he says, "Yeah, she's right." And they reunite, they remarry again. Lo and behold, Yocheved becomes pregnant. Miriam points to her mother's womb and says, "This will be the one who will liberate us from this slavery." This slavery, by the way, is interesting, the way it's described. What is, besides being unpaid, it's described as harsh labor with vigor, with rigor. And the definition of this from Maimonides is, it's not just working to the point of exhaustion. It's making someone do something that is completely meaningless. Because that way you just don't destroy a body, you destroy a spirit. An example that Maimonides gives is, I tell you, dig this hole, and you spend 3/4 of the day digging it, and then you're told, fill it. Mm-hmm. Over and over.
It's like breaking rocks.
Exactly. Exactly, to no purpose. So that's really what the effort was more than anything. So now Yocheved gives birth, and Miriam is right. According to the Midrash, according to the story surrounding the basic text, this is a magic baby. This is the Paul Bunyan of our tradition. This baby causes the house to be illuminated to create separation, like a Christmas tree. So this house is illuminated in Goshen, where the Jews live, and it shines for hundreds of miles. So there's no way to hide this little baby. So after 3 months, they decide they have to have him go. And Miriam, as the story goes, takes him down to the Nile, and she and her mother outfit this little ark for the baby, and they put in sweet-smelling fragrances so that he won't be so frightened and disturbed, and they put him in this, and they swaddle him and put him in the Nile. Along comes the Egyptian princess, the daughter of the Pharaoh, who has leprosy, and she comes down to the Nile every day to bathe because of the leprosy, and she steps into the water, and she immediately sees something floating at a great distance, and she hears a sound coming from it, and it's the sound of a grown man, because, again, this is part of Moses' magic. And she starts to walk towards this little floating ark, and her arm telescopes about 50 feet, because this is our Paul Bunyan story, and touches the ark, and guess what happens? Leprosy is gone. And then she realizes there's something very special about this baby. She sees from his, she looks into his diaper. She sees it's obviously a male baby, and it's a circumcised baby. Now, the question is that why was he, how did he survive to begin with? Because they had midwives who were supposedly Egyptian. And again, the commentary tells us that it isn't that you need to be a Jew or an Israelite to have compassion and empathy, humanity, if you will. This is within every one of us in this world. And these women, when the Pharaoh said, why are there male babies still being born? Say, those Hebrew women, they're like animals. I mean, they give birth and they're out in the fields before we can get to their babies. And it's what every group says about the underclass. They just breed like animals. So that's why Moses' life was spared. Now, who's watching this whole scene back at the Nile? Miriam. She puts her brother in the water, the baby, and the baby is floating in the water, and she watches this whole scene, and she sees the princess come up, and she says to the princess, when the princess says, "Oh, I want a child. I want this child. But who will feed this child?" And then Miriam pops out of the bulrushes and said, "Do I have a deal for you?" And this, to me, is one of the great, really the great business transactions in Torah. The mother actually gets to nurse her baby and get paid for it. Baby goes back to the mother, and when he's weaned, he's raised in the palace. And
by what, the Pharaoh's daughter.
By the Pharaoh's daughter. Now, right. Now again, the Pharaoh adores him, but the advisors mistrust him. And I'm giving you not just what's in the Torah, I'm giving you the outside story, because I think that really gives it its juice. So when he's about 3 years old, the advisors say, "I'm not sure about this one," because they're really fearing there's something about Moses, and they know that he's circumcised. So they say, "Let's see if he's an ordinary baby or if he's extraordinary." And they take a glowing coal, and then they take a cooled coal. So one is dull black, and the other is, you know, fiery, shining. And they put the baby down there, and Moses is Moses. So Moses is not going to go for the burning coal the way any normal child would. He's prescient enough to know to go for the dull one. At this moment, the angel Gabriel pushes his hand towards the shining coal, and he burns his hand, puts it to his lips, which burn his lips, and that explains why he can't speak well. Because later, as we cut later into the story, and he's now called back to, now he's before the Pharaoh, and because God, he stands before this burning bush. Again, fire is a very important metaphor in this, and this is God's fire, and God says to Moses, because he has fled, he is in Midian, because he has killed an Egyptian who is beating the Hebrew slaves. And God finds him in Midian as a shepherd, which is always a good beginning for a spiritual leader to be a shepherd, and says, "Return and free the people. Go to Pharaoh, ask him." And Moses says, I am of uncircumcised lips. I cannot speak." God says, "You think I don't know that? I made you. I know who I'm asking. You're the one." So he does return. His brother Aaron helps him in his speech. And as we know, he goes 10 times to the Pharaoh. "Let my people go." Just like the spiritual sings. Mm-hmm. And each time a plague is visited, beginning with blood in the Nile, each time the Pharaoh is frightened. And of course, these are tricks that reverse nature, because that's what the Egyptians really understand. And God's going to play their game. God's got one thing to prove. God's got to prove God is God. That is, there is none other. Whether the Egyptians get it or not is a political problem. But the Jews, the Hebrews, have to get it. So here is this God playing a game of magic to prove to the Hebrews, as well as the Israelites, as well as the Egyptians, that there is none other than this one who can do anything. And each time this happens, the Pharaoh has a moment where the Pharaoh really feels like, "Oh, I really want to get rid of them. Okay." And then each time, the Pharaoh relents. And then you get to a point where, and God says, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart." And this creates great dilemma for a reader, because I'm sure Dorothy, you, being a literary person, would say, "Wait a minute. First of all, where's the suspense? You know what's going to happen. God's setting it up. And now I've got a real problem with who's supposedly the hero of this story, God. Because what kind of a God hardens the heart
of the persecutor?"
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So here's the answer. One step leads to another in our lives. When we act with compassion the first time, it's easier the second time. When we turn away and we don't listen to that in ourselves, the first time it's the hardest, and then it gets easier. And by the time the Pharaoh gets into the middle of these plagues, the Pharaoh no longer has free will to even consider. There's no more relenting because the Pharaoh has lost his ability to choose, and he's lost his mind also to make a good rational decision for the survival of his own people. So then the story goes is that they get through the 10 plagues. The last plague is the most horrible of all, which is the slaying of the firstborn in Egypt, including the Pharaoh's son. The Israelites, amidst the wails of the Egyptians, not all the Israelites, by the way, many stayed behind. They had to be commanded to leave. And you always wonder, why would you need to be commanded to leave a situation of such oppression and persecution? Why does God listen when God listens? Because he realizes that there has been a turning point among the Israelites. They no longer even have the energy to protest what they're living through. Their spirits are dead. Get them out before their bodies die too. So they have to be commanded to leave. That's one answer. The other one is that maybe they were doing well there. Maybe the enslavement was more psychological. Maybe they were living in Beverly Hills. Maybe they were addicted to cocaine. Maybe they were addicted to Ferraris. Maybe the real enslavement is they completely lost their spiritual basis.
They were passive.
Exactly. They were passive either in extreme comfort or in extreme discomfort. So they have to be commanded. Those who listen get themselves together. They have to do it quickly. It's under a full moon, as it has been every year since for, 3,000 years. It's always a full moon for Passover. And they don't have time to let their bread rise. So hence the matzah, the unleavened bread, known as the bread of affliction and the bread of freedom. And they quickly take themselves to the Red Sea, as we know, or the Sea of Reeds, and then they're paralyzed. Oh, my God. And then there's one brave soul, Nachshon, who gets all credit for being remembered for a single act of courage. Nachshon is the first, and he steps into the water, and then if you've seen the movie, you know what happens. There are the walls of water, and they cross to the other side. Then the Egyptians follow them, and the water closes, and they sing the song of triumph. And God stops them, the Israelites, and says, "My children are drowning." So because of that, every Passover during the Seder, we have the cup of wine, and we, for each plague, take a drop out of our full cup of joy here, the cup of wine, to remember the suffering of the Egyptians because of what happened to Pharaoh. And that's the story of Passover.
Can you explain to us what happens at the Passover Seder?
Now, the Seder is, there's an expression that on Passover, Jews eat history. And that's exactly perfect, because the entire meal is, every food is connected symbolically. And we are commanded to tell our children every year. And this Seder, which means order, because it's a special order of prayers and foods, comes from the Greek talk feast, the symposium. We'd sit around the table, and you'd really enjoy. And of course, we were very influenced by the Greeks, so we really took this wonderful practice to not only tell our children what happened, but to recreate it, to relive it. And the child is central to the Seder. The child is central. And the reason the child is central is that there is no future without this transmission to the child. The child represents all that is unknown and what will be revealed. And that it is really, no matter what happens at that Passover Seder, you never want to lose the interest of the child. So throughout the Seder, we have all these little rewards and puzzles to sort of keep the child
engaged.
To involve exactly.
Whatever child is at the table.
Exactly.
And is there a chair that is empty, or is this some other event that I have confused with this.
You've got the right character.
Yes.
And the wrong expression for that moment. You have an empty chair for Elijah. And Elijah, but what you do have is you have an extra cup on the table.
Uh-huh.
And who is Elijah? Elijah is the one who will announce the coming of the Messiah. And let me just take a little piece here to define, you know, Messiah here, because...
Okay. Let's wait just a minute. We'll interrupt this just to tell our listeners that we are listening to Rabbi Malka Drucker, who is telling us the story of Passover. And this is the reading sampler. Okay, let's hear about the Messiah.
Okay. So, first of all, Judaism believes in the idea that Messiah means the anointed one. And the Messiah will be a human being, a regular human being, who knows something. I just spoke with Barbara Tedlock on Tuesday night. We talked about shamanism. I would say probably one who is a shaman might qualify as Messiah. I happen to think that every generation throws up lots of would-be messiahs, and what the world is waiting for is enough evolution within each spirit, within each of us, to recognize those who know something. And when the day comes that we have a world in which enough people recognize that this one speaks the language of survival and the language of truth, which is a language that tells us that we are interconnected, all of us, every sentient being, all of us who are part of this earth, and that we are inextricably interconnected, and that what hurts me hurts you, and what hurts you hurts me, and that when the day comes that we really understand this relationship, and that we're here most of all to bring love into this world, that will be the day that all of these would-be messiahs in every generation, that day will know. That day will say, this is the one who speaks for the world.
So sort of an enlightenment.
Exactly.
Would you say that might characterize some of the people that come to mind, like Gandhi, like Martin Luther King Jr.? So they don't have to be Jews.
Oh, no. I think that... there's nothing that says that this person needs to be a Jew, and there's also nothing that says this person has to be male.
Mm.
I think that it really is the idea that there will be a day when there's enough enlightenment that we'll all recognize. Judaism also believes that in the world to come, which is the Messianic era, that there will be no Jewish laws. There'll be no need for it. Because people will already know what they need, mm-hmm. except for one, which we just had, Purim, because the commandment for Purim is laughter. And in this life, as long as you breathe, that's one that you can't really escape.
Before we run out of time here, tell us about the community that you lead.
Hamakom, the place for passionate and progressive Judaism, is a fellowship here in Santa Fe that meets at St. Bede's every Saturday morning at 9:15. We have bagels and coffee, and we wrestle text together. Then we sing together. We share joys and concerns. We are at St. Bede's not just because it's physical shelter, but these are also our comrades. Father Murphy and I do things together in our communities. On March 19th, we spoke together we had a public conversation about many concerns that both our communities have, talking about Israel, talking about our future together, St. Bede's and Hamakom. And I welcome anyone to come and join us at St. Bede's.
What does that title mean?
Hamakom means the place, and it's one of the names of God, and that we find God in a place by how we behave with each other. But I'd like to say one final thing about Passover. It is ultimately a holiday of liberation, a holiday of freeing ourselves from slavery, each of us, day by day. And the slavery often is internal. And it's a great opportunity this time of year to look within ourselves, to say, what enslaves me? My fears, my envies, my hungers. Mm. And to look at this, and just as Egypt was the birthplace, it was a narrow country, the birth canal into the Red Sea, fetal waters part, a large dysfunctional family called the Israelites, step in together, have shared experience of terror and faith, come out on the other side, born as a people. It's the birthday of the Jewish people.
It's really a wonderful story.
Thank you.
And it's so easy to see how it affects us in our lives, in our thinking about where we're where we're at in this particular terror-ridden part of our world history. Can people, just anybody, join your community?
Anyone can join. Anyone is welcome. We want more than joining in this life. We want belonging. Mm-hmm. So that if this is the right place, we want to belong to you as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, Malka, is there one final thing you'd like to tell us about the story or about your community?
Well, I think what I'd like to say is that one of the important pieces in this life is that we have to, first of all, know very deeply who we are in order to become really good friends with others. Mm-hmm. And I would invite everyone to, the only people I don't understand in this life are people who have no path beyond themselves. And the wonderful thing about this story is that it is about people who are enslaved, and many of us are enslaved with our own problems, our own self-absorption. So I would invite everybody in this season, regardless of their spiritual path, mm-hmm. to take spring, because this comes in the time of spring, and its seasonal energy is birth. This is the birth of a people. It's the birth of self. And I think that this is a great opportunity to look to one's own enslavements and see what we can do to move them.
I think it's a wonderful invitation that you're giving. We have been listening to Rabbi Malka Drucker of the HaMakom community of Santa Fe, New Mexico, telling us the story of Passover and its meaning in our lives today. We want to thank you really very much for being with us today, Rabbi Malka Drucker.
My pleasure. Let me just leave you with a phone number, 992-1905. You'll get a call back.
Grand. This is The Reading Sampler, a program of contemporary literature. Hear this program Thursdays at 6:30, KSFR 90.7 FM, on Santa Fe community-supported public radio. Your guide in sampling the literature of today is Dorothy Doyle.